Hello and welcome to Films That Time Forgot, a podcast where we look at somewhat overlooked Hollywood films from the 80s through to the early 2010s. I'm Adam Thornton, your host, and joining me on this episode is Scott Murphy.
Hi, thanks for having me back, Adam.
Now, Scott, could you tell the any new listeners, although you've done this in loads of episodes before, what do you do?
What do I do? Well, I currently host a podcast called All 90s Action All the Time, which looks at 90s action films. We look at the kind of the corresponding year to the year that's happening. So this year of 2025, we're looking at the action movies of 1995. We kicked off the year with our annual January episode, where we looked at Rumble in the Bronx. And yeah, throughout the year we'll be looking at action movies from 1995. And I guess, like, tying in with the film that we're going to look at today, I used to host a podcast called New Horror Express, where I would interview horror film directors, actors, writers, also as well as that, like, horror novelists, just anybody connected with the world of indie horror. And I hosted that from 2018 through to last year. There's about 185 episodes, all of which are still available.
Well, tying into horror, today's film we're going to be looking at is the 2005 Kate Hudson starring, I think it's the only horror film she's been in her career, horror film The Skeleton Key. It's directed by Ian Softley, who again, like Hudson, is a newcomer to horror. He directed the Beatles biopic Backbeat and the Kevin Spacey inspirational sci-fi film from 2001. That's a very 2001 genre film, K-Pax. Scott, what did you think of it? Because it's kind of in I think it's a pretty interesting film that you don't hear much about in many, many ways.
So I wasn't sure if I had seen this before. I think I have, but I wasn't confident enough that I didn't put it down as a rewatch when I logged it on Letterboxd. I don't know. I mean, I guess we'll get into it. I guess I was pretty meh on it, to be honest. I wasn't necessarily the biggest fan of it. I initially put it down as 2 stars, but after a couple of days after I watched it, I was having a bad movie night with a friend, and I rewatched The Wicker Man remake.
Oh yeah,
And
great,
I
yeah.
reflected back on this movie. I reflected back on this movie, and I was like, ah, I guess I could up it to 2.5 stars. Like, I'm still pretty on it, so I'm still in the process of reconsidering it. But no, overall, there's some good stuff here, and we'll get into that. But, like, I think there's some issues I have with it, and some of it I think it's just because, like, I've seen a lot of horror from that time, and so some of the kind of scare tricks it uses I find quite funny and not scary, because it just feels like, oh, that's very 2005. And I think that, like, it is, I think, like, part of my issue with it is that, like, it thinks it's very good. I think, like, that's I like and I guess I'll explain that a little bit further. I think you can, like, make, like, a really twisted atmospheric horror film, even if it's got some cliches, or you can make, like, a film that's just kind of, like, entertaining. And, like, if it's just entertaining, then you can kind of overcome the kind of cliches, because, like, for example, The Conjuring is just a compendium of haunted house cliches, but because it's done in quite an entertaining roller coaster ride style, it kind of overcomes that. Whereas this film thinks it's at like this film thinks it's elevated horror when it's not.
Yeah.
I think that's part of my issue with
Well, it
the
kind of, I
film.
mean, I would argue it sits somewhere in between like your standard blockbuster horror and what we now know as elevated horror. It's kind of this weird in between mixture of both that sometimes works and sometimes doesn't quite gel.
I think that's right, and I think that's part of my issue with it. I think it never. I admire the fact that it doesn't just go in for cheap scares, but it kind of does sometimes. And I think like it ne like for me, while I admire the swing, I think it did need to kind of more commit to one lane or the other, because it's dipping its toe in what we now call quote unquote elevated horror, even though, you know, there's always been elevated horror. You can go back to things like The Shining or Possession, or even further back to things like Eyes Without a Face, or you know, whatever. You know, there's always been elevated horror. So it's a bullshit phrase. But anyway, like that's a whole different kettle of
Oh, yeah.
fish. But it kind of dips its toe in kind of being like this, like really atmospheric, really slow burn type horror. But it feels like maybe because of the era of the time, like it doesn't quite fully commit to it, and then it throws cheap scares in as well, just to be like, oh well, we need to do this as well. So I think like if it more fully committed to like being, if it wanted to be like truly what we would now refer to in the present era as elevated horror, I think if it kind of tried to more fully commit to that.
Yeah.
Or just more fully commit to being like a wacky haunted house possession, like just cliches galore, but more of an entertaining roller coaster ride. Yeah, I think that kind of in-betweeniness I found a little frustrating.
I mean, I think to be fair, it'd be kind of hard to go with the roller coaster horror with the kind of plot, the serious
Yeah, no,
nature
that's
of
true.
the plot that it has. And I mean, I would argue that one of the things the film does do well is a lot of its characterization. Like, you've got the opening kind of scenes with the Kate Hudson character, Caroline, who's working as an elderly, as a nurse in retirement home for elderly people. And the way she deals with her last patient I mean, it's a hospital that she works at, but she's dealing with this dying man and reading to him and not liking having to dispose of his stuff, and how she then kind of quits that job to move on to working at this for this elderly couple at this mansion. And then we later find out her reasons for doing so are because she wasn't there for her dad when he died. That does kind of give the character some sort of a bit more motivation than just, oh, she's this innocent who randomly wanders into this retirement home. It's, you know, and I think Kate Hudson does a good job of playing that sort of empathetic, caring side, as well as the more kind of harder edge side that we see coming later on.
Yeah, my frustrations with the movie don't tend to come with the characters. I think like it tends to come like first of all, I guess like splitting things up. And this is like I said, you know, initially I put it down as a two, and I think that was maybe a bit harsh. Maybe I should put it down as a 2.5, because like I think it is more of a middling effort, and I think like. I'm not sure it's a good horror film, is what I think,
Right.
for me. Like, I don't like, there is plenty of films that are like slow burn, that like a lot of it is like building atmosphere, a lot of it is like a camera tracking around an empty house and like tra and building the atmosphere and making it disturbing, and you know, making it kind of like, you know, that kind of creepiness, that kind of getting under your skin. And this movie doesn't scare me. And I'm not saying that every movie has to be like terrifying or
No.
whatever. It doesn't. To be an effective horror, it doesn't. Like, horror films can be effective horror in all sorts of different ways. But like, I think for me, like its attempts at being a horror, other than a couple of bits, I just don't find it effective. I find like the bits where it's trying to be horror quite dull.
Right.
However, I do think, and maybe this goes to the director's background, because he's got quite an interesting career before he comes to this film. I think like the drama bits are quite good. I think that the characterization of everybody is quite good. I think like Kate Hudson is pretty good. I think that Peter Sarsgaard's pretty good. I think that even though he doesn't speak throughout the movie, I think John Hurt does a very good physical performance. And of course, Jenna Rollins completely steals the film.
Oh, she does.
Like, it's completely 100% her film. So like, and in terms of that, and in terms of like, I found like the actual plot quite interesting. And I found the back history that we'll get into, quite interesting, and all of that. I think this is quite interesting. I just don't think it works for me as a horror film.
Right. Yeah. I mean, I actually kind of liked what I thought was the slow burn nature, because we go from the Kate Hudson going to her new employer's house where she meets is it Gina or Jenna Rollins? I can't work out the.
So I wasn't sure on this, but I watched on YouTube. Somebody has helpfully uploaded all the DVD extras as one video. So there's like all these like
Oh yeah.
mini documentaries that they've just smooshed together as like one 45-minute video. So I watched that yesterday, and she calls herself Jenna Rollins, and everybody
Okay.
else refers her to Jenna Rollins. So
Jenna,
I'm gonna
yeah.
go with that. That's what she says in like
Okay.
the behind the scenes featurettes.
So Jenna Rollins to so Jenna Rollins and her husband, who's played by John Hurt, who's in a wheelchair, is completely paralyzed, and he's the main patient that Kate Hudson's going to be looking after. And we also get Peter Sarsgaard as the couple's lawyer, and it's interesting that he's kind of got a very close relationship with Jenna Rollins almost right away. And I thought that was kind of effective foreshadowing, like he's towards the twist at the end, but he's a lot more familiar with her than you'd expect. And there's also mentioned that the John Hurt character was paralyzed by a stroke in the attic, which again comes into focus later. And although Kate Hudson isn't really wanting to take up the caretaker position because Jenna Rollins doesn't seem to be friendly towards her, she gets really pushed into it by the lawyer. And so yeah, that whole scene I really like. It kind of establishes sort of the way it establishes the characters and their whole kind of dynamics. And particularly when you sort of know the twist later on, it doesn't kind of say, oh, look, there's a big twist coming on, but it sort of hints that, oh, there's something else going on here that unfolds later on in the film. Now, the scene after this, where Kate Hudson stops off at a gas station, and now I don't know if this is maybe like the cheap attempt at horror that you're thinking of, because whilst it does set up kind of the main theme of the film, which is dealing with a form of voodoo, and it looks quite kind of creepy and atmospheric with all the sort of animal bits sort of like strewn around the place. It does kind of use a bit of a cheap jump scare where I think the owner comes up behind Kate Hudson. So I don't know if that's kind of tying into what you were saying.
Well, yeah, I mean, like, this is the I mean, like that is definitely one scene that I can point to. I'd be like, I think it's just because it's a very familiar scene. It's the kind of scene that's like skewered in like Cabin in the Woods,
Oh,
where
yeah.
like and like oh, there's an empty gas station, and there's like a creepy gas station owner, and then there's the blind woman, and
Yeah.
all that kind of stuff, and she, and like I expected that to be more like her to like give more of a warning in that scene, because that tends to be what happens in those types of scenes. So yeah, there is a bunch of scenes like this within the film that are not scary because because like they don't do enough of like a twist on a scene that we've seen so many times before. Of like this is like the kind of foreshadowing of the horrors to come, and like this happens in tons of horror movies. And you see, and again, like I think a lot of this depends on how many how into horror you are, how many horror films you've seen, because like if you have been a horror fan for a while, I think like a lot of horror fans watch a scene like this, which doesn't bring anything new to the table and does it in quite a kind of ham-fisted way, will just kind of roll their eyes at this scene and just be like, well, yeah, okay, we've been
But
here and we've done that,
would you say ham,
and
but would you say ham-fisted though? Because I don't know. I thought there's like quite a creepy build-up until like the gas station owner comes up behind her. I thought that the way she's kind of looking around the room, and we kind of see the kind of blind old woman hidden behind a door. I don't know. I mean, I can definitely see. I can see a much more cliched version of that scene.
I
With
guess
like
so, but
really
like with
creepy
the
music.
creepy with the I guess that's true. It like in the moment it felt quite paint by numbers to me.
Yeah, although I think it's maybe kind of hard to see how they'd subvert it. I mean, I don't know, because I think it kind of, I
I
think
don't
this is
know.
also a kind of film where it kind of slowly amps up the horror rather than sort of hitting you with anything big, because it's like in the next scene we see the Kate Hudson character notices, like it's just a mild thing, but it's like missing mirrors on the walls, like there's no mirrors at all. And when she's looking after John Hurt on the first night, he just quickly grabs her hand, and he like and she manages to get him off her. But they're not like big sort of jump scare moments, but they're just like little moments that are like, oh,
Yeah.
okay, there's something more here. It's not like massively, it's like starting off with a massive scare, but it's almost like just a small thing just to ease the audience in.
No, and like I say, and I mean because I think like the last time we covered a horror movie, with 14 Weight, I sometimes like kind of damned it by comparison to like amazing horror films. So like I think without like comparing it to like something like 5-star masterpiece or whatever, but I've seen like other horror slow burn. You know, like there's movies, and there's even movies that like that other people think are real dull that I'm real into. Ty West did a movie called The Innkeepers, which a lot of people think like that doesn't work at all. And I think like the slow burn horror in that works. It's kind of like, for a lot of the movie, it's kind of a hangout movie between like these two characters in like an empty hotel. But I think that like really, it really creeps up in you, and like, you know, like the final act of that movie really hits hard because like it's been like a very, very slow build. And then it kind of whacks you with that final act. And there's other movies as well, that are very slow burn, oh, what's that movie? The Lodge. The Lodge is a pretty cool kind of slow burn horror movie. So I'm not against the slow burn, but I think you've got to build like a thicker atmosphere. Like I think like in those movies, I feel immersed in the atmosphere of it, and maybe like I'm trying to work it out myself now, like why like I feel this is like to me duller or like kind of
Because
more
this is, I mean, I would argue this is pretty atmospheric. Like you've got the whole kind of swampy surroundings because this is close to, I mean, the house she's working in is close to New Orleans, and the whole film is set in New Orleans. It's
Oh yeah, that's true. That's true.
you've got like the swamps, you've got like
Yeah.
the way the
Although the
trees
funny
hang
thing is,
over.
from the behind the scenes featurettes, the fun thing about that is like the old plantation house that they got to film in, the location, they really liked the location, and they really liked that house, and they tried to convince the owners to give them that location or whatever, and they succeeded. But The one thing about that was that it was in farmland. It's nowhere near a swamp. So they
No.
built the swamp next to the house themselves. There was like a production designer and then like added like some CGI on top to make it like more make it look more realistic or whatever. But like you see them like kind of
Oh yeah.
like kind of carving out the swamp themselves out the out of some farmland.
But
It
it's
was quite
still
cool.
kind of atmospheric, and also you've got
Oh
like the you've also got the New Orleans kind of stuff as well, which is interesting. You've got like the jazz culture, and you've got the whole kind of hoodoo religion as a backdrop, which you get to kind of which you get to investigate, and which is an interesting kind of shift from, not something you'd get in something like, say, The Conjuring. It's really
I mean,
taps
like,
into the
yeah,
folklore of the
definitely
place.
not. Definitely not something you would see in the definitely not sort of something you would see in The Conjuring. But like you could argue both ways, you know, I think like it's certainly, you know, reading other people's reviews, some people felt like quite atmospheric. And then you know, and I think you can see it kind of argue it both ways. I've seen some people say that they felt it was very atmospheric for them. I've seen some people say that it's just it's maybe it's like they felt it was a bit too cliched, because it very much ties into like, and it's very I guess to give the film credit, it's very hard not to be cliche if you're going for like a kind of Southern Gothic. It's very hard not to just be a checklist of like Louisiana, New Orleans cliches. And I don't know how you do it in like a, you know, like I'm not a clever enough, like, you know, I'm not a filmmaker, and I'm not clever enough to be like, oh, this is how you make a non-cliched Southern Gothic that really feels, you know, punchy and original. Like, so like I'm not saying that. But yeah, I think like
I mean,
I wasn't personally drawn into the atmosphere. I could see what they were doing, but I didn't feel immersed in it. I because like I could, sometimes you can feel immersed in a film, and sometimes you kind of are watching the mechanics of a film, and you kind of like you see what they're doing, but like you're like ah, you're kind of one step removed. And maybe part of the one step removed thing is like the film is done in a very slick, very mid-2000s style, and maybe that's part of why I was watching the mechanics rather than being immersed in the atmospherics. And not at all times. There were some times I was really drawn into it, and I think some of the storytelling, like I said, and is good, and I think the acting is very good. But yeah, so but again, it seems it, you know it, that it's just, you know, different things, different strokes for different folks. And I think like some people could very well be drawn into the atmospherics because I think some of it is quite effective.
Yeah, I mean, what I think is effective is when Kate Hudson's discovering the mystery of the house, like when she finds a childhood photo of the house's previous owners with their black servants, and then she finds that the skeleton key, hey, title of the film there, that she's given by Jenna Rowlands, opens every door in the house, but it doesn't open the attic door. And there's lots of this kind of banging sounds behind the attic door, and there's an effective scene actually where the door, I mean, you'd say this is cliched, I think it's effective, where she's trying to get the attic door open, but then the door behind her in the room next to the attic kind of closes shut. Again, I thought that there's a pretty effective build-up. I mean, again, you could argue it's horror 101, but I think I think Ian Softley does a pretty good job of sort of, establishing that the place is quite kind of atmospheric and creepy. Like there's all sorts of religious statues and kind of paintings. But I don't think he goes too over the top with it. I mean, I don't know.
Well, as you've like preempted any criticism I can make,
Yes, okay, we can move on.
we
We can move on with me talking about the plot, which is so the audience knows what we're going on about. So anyway, later on in the night, you've got Kate Hudson hearing banging sounds coming from John Hurt's room and finds him crawling on the roof. Which one? It's apparently John Hurt did this himself, which is impressive. And second of all,
Oh,
there's
he didn't do the fall himself. He
no, he
wasn't
did.
allowed. Insurance didn't allow him to do the fall himself.
Yeah, he didn't fall off the roof, but he actually when it's him on the roof where there's a storm raging, it's him
He
actually.
wanted to do the fall, but he was told by like lawyers that he
Yeah,
couldn't.
and it's I mean, and he's actually really great throughout the film. I mean, obviously he's played kind of speech impaired characters before, but this is a guy who barely says. The character of Ben can barely speak, and yeah, John Hurt does a really good job of showing his terror and desperation at the way he's kind of wanting to get out. And yeah, I
And
mean,
also, like I think that I think this is a really good scene. I think like in terms of like the kind of the mystery and the horror, I think like the way it's filmed, you've got the way John Hurt is showing the terror in his eyes, the way that like it's just like absolutely pouring down with rain, and it's rainy, it's muddy, it's kind of like it's got a kind of muggy atmosphere. I think like and Kate Hudson finding the covers that have got "Help me" written in red, and
yeah.
like all that. I think like so there is moments, there's gems in this movie for sure. There is moments that I found like really quite affecting, and that's one of them.
Yeah, and also the next scene, there's some pretty interesting moments again between Kate Hudson and Peter Sarsgaard, where she's trying to show him the help me note, but it's not there. And Jenna Rowlands kind of walks in on them and gets like jealous almost of Sarsgaard. She's like, why are you two together? And initially you're thinking, oh, it's for some reason she's got this odd relationship with the lawyer. Does she fancy him? Is there what's going on there? And then, but again, that's just a nice bit of foreshadowing. I think the problem
I think
is
that's
that.
good. I think like you can again, it kind of it gives with one hand and takes away with the other. Because I guess like the kind of like the covers being like switched around and stuff like that is kind of of course like the protagonist has to be kind of isolated and made to look kind of crazy and or whatever. Again, that is kind of horror filmmaking 101. But the Peter Sarsgaard Jenna Rowlands thing, where it kind
Yeah.
of like, yeah, again, we're kind of continuing this kind of interesting, kind of weirdly kind of sexual dynamic that you think like, okay, is there something there? And you kind of like that you question and ties into the ending. So that's good. So like again, like there's a kind of constant push pull for me of like kind of like, oh.
So, moving on now to the more horror stuff, what did you think of the scene where Kate Hudson goes breaks into the attic and finds out that it's full of creepy hoodoo or voodoo objects?
So I did actually quite like yeah, it has some moment because we get like a lot of kind of we get again a lot of the camera movements and the editing is very much of the time. So we get a lot of whooshiness, we get a lot
Yeah.
of and we get a lot of kind of like kind of surreptitious kind of like slow zooms, then fast zooms into keyholes and stuff like that. That was a bit like, okay, right, got it. I think once he actually gets into the room, I think that's an interesting scene. And I do think that they did a very good, like, because you see it in the behind the scene featurettes, the band they got to do the creepy Papa Justified recording.
Yeah.
And like that is cool. Like and that's like they've done a really good job with that, and that is that actual recording is really quite creepy, and
Yeah.
I think they did that well. I got to give this film
Yeah.
the kudos it deserves. So like I think that was really good.
Yeah, because she finds this LP of Papa Justify, who's the male kind of servant in the photo. he's recording, which is this spell, and it's, and I think they say it's like a reincarnation spell. And then she finds a spell book with it's got something about a protection spell written on it, and a weird sort of ring as well that's got like snakes on it. But it's so this is like the first time we're properly introduced to like the hoodoo stuff, and it's yeah, it's that's one part of the film that's, I think we can both agree as you've just said, Scott, that's one part of the film that we can both agree is really well done. When we listen to the recording, it actually sounds like something that would have been recorded back in the 20s.
Oh yeah, absolutely, absolutely. The blues musicians that they got to do that did a really great job. And the way that they managed to make obviously managed to make the record sound like it's like a kind of old 20s kind of record. They did a really good job with that. And I don't know, absolutely, the definite thumbs up on that one.
Now the next scene, this is something that I kind of take issue with, because for a film about black culture, Kate Hudson's friend, who kind of explains to her that the attic that she found is a hoodoo room, and tells her about hoodoo, that it's basically a folk religion that's harmless only if you don't believe in it, and kind of in and she's the only sort of black character who's, well, she's really the only black character with any sort of major agency in the film that we see that's visible. And I don't know how problematic that is.
So I guess like it is problematic to an extent. I do think that like watching the movie and we're learning a little bit about voodoo and hoodoo and the difference between the two, and voodoo is a faith and a religion, and hoodoo is not a religion. It is a magical practice. It's different
Sorry.
types of it's ma magic, so it's just a practice. And yeah, like you say, it's about belief, and they have this thing of like if you don't believe it doesn't work on you, but if you believe it can work, it can work on you. And yes, like I think it's at no point do I think this film is explicitly racist.
No.
But I do think it has, and this again, still common for the time. This wouldn't kind of change until into the 2010s. It has a, I'll use the word ham-fisted again. It like has a kind of ham-fisted liberalism, where it's trying to be, I think it's even trying to be anti-racist, but
Oh yeah.
it's trying to be anti-racist, but it's doing it in this very kind of, through a white lens. And I think it's the kind of movie we probably wouldn't get now, which is fair enough.
Yeah.
Where like you say, the character Jill, played by Jo Bryant, is like the only black character that has who has like a character, who has like a personality, who has like an agency. She's kind of the skeptical best friend who's maybe like a little bit of a audience avatar and all that, and then the rest of the black characters are like mainly just there to give exposition to our white leads, and like the other main characters, like you say, the kind of four the four main characters are all white. And I just yeah, it does. There is like a part of you that feels like there's an awkwardness there, like watching it, 20 years removed. It does feel a bit awkward, and it does feel a bit like, should we be telling this, story? I mean, I don't know if you, I mean, this story, this type of story, I don't know how much I should give away right now when we're, maybe closer to the ending, but like this type of story and the subject
Yeah.
matter, should we be telling this through a white lens? Probably not.
No,
I think this movie has good intentions, but
I
like
think
I think yeah, it does sit awkwardly.
nowadays I think it would definitely be told from a black perspective by a black director,
Which is
which I think
probably better,
much,
yeah.
I would say so, because, well, the next scene actually is kind of following on from what we're saying, where where Kate Hudson is told by Jenna Rowlands the story of the two black servants in the photos she found, Mama Cecile and Papa Justify, and during a party that their employer had at the house, they wanted to get revenge on him for basically for basically being abusive to them. So they taught the employer's two young white children. They took them upstairs in the attic and basically used Papa Justify's spell to swap bodies with the children. So their spirits ended up in the children's bodies and the children's spirits ended up in their bodies. And then when the employer and the party guests found them up in the attic, they took the bodies of Cecile and Justify out and hung them. And the lynching is shown in a really graphic fashion. We see them getting strung up from the tree. We see them getting set on fire. It's also shot in a very sort of weird MTV style way with a lot of speed ramping, like speeding ups and slowing down the footage and switching to black and white.
And the like, yeah, I guess I was gonna ask you that, like, I found, you know, like you say, the lynching itself is quite visceral. It's quite visceral and horrible to, you know, to watch, but
It's the only like real, really visceral moment in the film because the film itself is actually very low key apart from that one moment.
I think, no, absolutely, absolutely. I think, like, the lynching scene itself is, it goes pretty hard, and it is pretty horrible, and it should be horrible.
But
I'm not so sure about the, I wasn't so sure about the flipping between, black and white. I'm not a huge fan, of that kind of mid-2000s editing, and I'm not. I think when they flip from color to black and white and flip back and forth between that later on in the movie,
yeah, that makes sense.
I think that works quite well, but I didn't like that effect in this moment.
It also feels kind of distasteful. It's interesting because you've kind of criticized the film for being quite kind of low, too kind of horror 101 and restrained. But this is the one time where it's almost going too far in the way it's showing the lynching and a more restrained. I think nowadays, a more restrained approach would have been used to depict that kind of event.
Because, like, I think, yes, I think you're right. And I think, like, it does come across as a little distasteful. And I think, like, it robs, like, because you obviously filmed quite a visceral scene. And I think the fancy editing and the flipping between color and black and white kind of robs it of the weight that it should have.
And
So to, yeah.
it's clearly meant to have emotional weight. It's not just meant to shock the audience.
Oh no, that's true. It's clearly because, like, I mean, like, this whole movie is, I mean, obviously, Ian Softley's background before this, he's done, like, I mean, he did Hackers as well, but he did like dramas and stuff, you know. He did that Beatles film Backbeat, you know. K-Pax is kind of like an oddball sci-fi drama. He did, like, Wings of the Dove, which is like a very kind of Merchant Ivory type film, even though I always thought it was a Merchant Ivory production, but it's
All
not.
right.
You know, as far as I could see, it was produced by Miramax or some shit.
Oh.
I always said, because it's like, anyway.
Yeah. It
So it's character driven and stuff like that. But no, I do think that, like, it feels reckless, and we've used the word distasteful a number of times, but, like, it feels reckless, it feels distasteful, to do kind of the swishy editing and that kind of slick mid-2000s type horror when dealing with a scene like this. I think if they had just stuck with the black and white and just played out the
Yeah.
scene in a more normal fashion, and then we just got we'd got the full effect of the
Yeah.
visceralness of that lynching. I think that could have been a very, and I guess that's the problem with that kind of, like, slick mid-2000s thing, is, like, it's a blocker to emotion.
Weren't
It
we
like it pro it
also?
provides it provides a barrier, and I think, like, it just Yeah, you know, you need to let the emotion of that scene play out, I think.
Yeah, weren't we also getting into like torture porn at that time as well with the Saw films? So, because that felt a little bit.
Yes, we definitely were. Saw came out in 2004. We'd already had precursors to it, like, because in 2003 we got like Cabin Fever, and we got House of a Thousand Corpses, and then 2005 is the year of films like Devil's Rejects, Hostel. So yeah, we're very much in that territory at this point in horror. Yeah.
Yeah, because I'm wondering if Ian Softley, being kind of a newcomer to horror, he wasn't so confident in how to shoot scenes like that. So he kind of looked at, what's everybody else doing? Oh, I'll just copy what they're doing stylistically without thinking about how it really would work, viewing it, in terms of sensitivity or.
Yeah, it comes off as a bit crass, the way it's done in the movie. And I think that they obviously filmed a powerful scene, but if they just played it a bit more traditionally, it would retain that power. But because of the way it's done and the way it's edited and the camera effects that they do with it, it kind of robs it of whatever power it would have had.
Yeah, it's a shame because, again, the next scene goes back to the more kind of restrained horror, and I think it, and I think it works really well. It works a lot better than the way they filmed that lynching scene because Kate Hudson's giving John Hurt a bath, and she gets told by Gina Rowlands in the scene beforehand that they say you can still see. Mama Cecile and Papa Justify in the mirrors in the house, which is why she's taking them all down. And she also mentions something about using brick dust as a barrier to keep out evil spirits, which again comes into play later on. But in this scene, John Hurt's being bathed, and he freaks out when Kate Hudson shows him his reflection in a mirror. And the way it's done is. And again, it's just John Hurt freaking out in a bathtub, but it's a lot more effective than all the sort of stylized effects that were used in the flashback scene.
Yeah,
And
no,
also.
I would agree with that. I would absolutely agree with that. And it's, you know, and like you say, there's like a kind of like a slow build to it, because she's just giving him a bath, and then she like kind of she's sitting there like, you know, I think she's like touching up her makeup or something, like just sitting on the toilet, and she obviously can't see anything. And then she remembers the thing about the mirror, and then shows John Hurt the mirror, and then obviously he just has a complete freak out, and then she's like, "Oh right, you can see them." And then it does tie into this thing of like belief, you know, of like at that moment in the film, she doesn't believe, and so therefore can't see anything.
Although
But he can.
I think she starts to think that there's something to this hoodoo stuff because she goes to a hoodoo shop that her friend showed her that her friend showed her was there. She goes in there, buys a cure for John Hurt, and then uses it on
So
him.
like yeah, yes, no, but like, so I think she even there's I think there's even a line to her friend or something, but they kind of go out their way to suggest or imply that like she doesn't believe, but she's picking this stuff up because she feels she can help the character of Ben, played by John Hurt, because he believes.
Yeah, it's a
But she's still
psychosomatic thing.
skeptical. She is just doing her job as like a nurse of like dealing with these
Yeah.
psychosomatic symptoms. But it's suggested that like at that moment, where even though she's getting this stuff to kind of quote unquote cure him, that she it's not her belief. She is just like
No.
purely picking it up because he believes and
No.
wants to help him.
Yeah, I don't think, I mean, she's not obviously buying into the whole hoodoo thing right away, but I think it's a moment where she's starting to believe. She's like, okay, maybe this stuff isn't real, but it could help, so I'm gonna, maybe try it. So she's not quite in the stage of like fully believing, but she's starting to come round to the idea that, oh, maybe this will work. It's more of a gradual thing, and she uses the cure in John Hurt, and it temporarily kind of releases him from whatever's affecting him, and he tells her to get out. And then, of course, is it Gina or Jenna again? I keep forgetting.
Oh, it's like
Gina,
yeah.
isn't
I'm
it?
just going. No, it's Jenna. It's Jenna. I'm going from
Jenna.
the behind the scenes footage that she
Jenna.
calls herself, Jenna Rollins.
Okay, right. Jenna Rollins. Okay. In case she's listening, sorry, Jenna, if I've mispronounced your name. Then Jenna Rollins bursts into the
Didn't she
room.
pass away last year? I think she
I
passed away last year,
believe she
Jenna.
did, yeah, because wasn't she in that film, A Woman Under the Influence, that got a lot of attention recently?
That's true. I've not yet seen that. In fact, that's one of the that's one of those kind of iconic directors I've not seen any movies by.
Yeah,
I've
because
not seen any of his.
she was married to John Cassavetes, and Nick
That's right.
Cassavetes is their son, and he's had a very interesting career on his own. He's kind of gone in a completely different direction from his dad. But anyway, she kind of bursts into the room and kind of stops John Hurt from getting any better, and kind of feeds him this sort of remedy that sedates him, which again comes into play later. A lot of this is kind of effective foreshadowing for what happens in the ending, but I kind of like how it's given to you. It's kind of drip fed to you throughout the film. It's not just like, oh, massively spelled out in one scene and then all just comes out of nowhere at the end. It's like, if you pay attention, you can see these little moments.
No, for sure. I mean, they definitely kind of seed things throughout the film, for sure. So there is some effective storytelling going on in the movie.
What do you think of the nightmare sequence that comes after this? Because Kate Hudson has a nightmare where she's having this sort of conjuring ritual performed on her by Mama Cecile and Papa Justify, and it's got more sorts of like stock horror imagery than the rest of the film has. Like, it's got her in a bed, kind of, with the candles around her. It's got, clips of, I think, a shot of Kate Hudson with her eyes and mouth sewn up that she used a lot in the trailer. I thought that was the one moment in the film that didn't work as well. I thought, well, I kind of feel like whenever Ian Softley uses more kind of like overtly horror stuff, it doesn't work as well.
I mean, I guess the actual image of the eyes and mouth being shown up, that's pretty cool. But I guess there's a kind of I mean, as I actual like that's a creepy image in and of itself. But yes, like you say, like the kind of dream montage, I guess it's maybe kind of too a little too kind of like Nine Inch Nails music video-y. To be actually scary.
It does kind of feel like Ian Softley is just sort of using like any sort of random imagery. No, not random imagery, but sort of like quote unquote scary imagery to try and maybe add a bit more horror to the film. Whereas I think if it had just played it as more of a like low key mystery drama up until the end, I think it would have been more effective.
And I wonder, I guess there is certain moments like that, and there is a kind of there's a couple other moments that I feel a little bit more kind of conventional kind of jump scares and stuff like that. There's a moment where there's a Jenna Rollins jump scare where
Oh, yeah.
she just suddenly appears and stuff like that, and like. Yeah, I guess it's hard to know what they wanted to do, what they planned to film, and what was and what producer notes they got and stuff like that. I guess we just don't know. There could be they could have got an executive at Universal or whatever. They were like, oh, can you add maybe a couple of jump scares,
Yeah,
or
because the.
I don't know. I don't know if that's maybe because it seems Ian Softley, it seems like he's that what he wants to do is have a kind of character driven horror drama, rather than like a showy horror film, despite all the camera trickery of the day. So I do wonder if like maybe they were asked to put in a couple of other jump scares or a
Yeah.
couple of more conventional horror imagery and
But because they do feel quite inserted in, because it doesn't really, and they do kind of jar with like the rest of the film, because the film is again this low, kind of very low key tone, which sort of makes any kind of like additions of any obvious horror moments just seem really jarring. You're like, what?
Yeah, no, I guess that is the problem with that, if you like are going for like a kind of slow build, atmospheric kind of character driven horror or kind of drama, if you then like insert kind of conventional jump scares or conventional mainstream kind of blockbuster horror kind of imagery. Then that's always going to come off looking more silly than it would in just a
Yeah.
conventional kind of big time horror, the kind of horror that you often get from like a Blumhouse or whatever that kind of stuff or
Yeah, I mean,
so I don't know.
I'm wondering if this film was made today, whether it would actually be better handled, because you wouldn't have that pressure coming from some big studio like Universal. To make it
Well,
more
I
kind
mean,
of to make it more
yeah.
conventional, you know, a studio like say A24 would allow a more left field take or a more subtle take.
I think like an audience, I think also like there's always been slow burn atmospheric horror, for many, many years. But I think in terms of like a mainstream audience, I think over the last decade, films like It Follows and The Witch and Hereditary and The Babadook and all these kind of films has kind of like more normalized slow burn horror. So like like even a mainstream audience is kind of more used to that type of horror, that rhythm of horror, and I think that has become particularly popular amongst kind of younger horror fans as well. Because obviously like your Neons and your A24s and stuff like that is definitely they definitely have strong fan bases generally, but like particularly amongst like kind of younger under 30s kind of horror fans and stuff like that. So like so yeah, I think this would be made very, very differently today where slow burn horror has become like a more normalized, more mainstream thing than it was 20 years ago.
Yeah, because I mean the whole sort of mystery, I mean particularly kind of like the whole kind of mystery aspect and the racial aspects in particular, like in the next scene where Kate Hudson persuades kind of Peter Sarsgaard, that there's something that Gina Rowlands is doing something to John Hurt, and they interview the last nurse who looked after John Hurt. And the nurse is black, and there's this and it's heavily implied that she believes in hoodoo, and she suggests that Gina Rowlands has put this sort of spell on John Hurt to kind of paralyze him. And she also mentions that the previous owners of the house, the brother and the sister, also ended up dying of strokes similar to what John Hurt had. And the nurse also tells Kate Hudson to leave the house. That whole sort of idea that the black nurses are suspicious of something that the white characters aren't, and even the whole sort of implications of body switching reminded me a bit of a Get Out.
Yeah, I mean, like, I guess, like, I guess that's what I've kind of been thinking through our conversation. I mean, I guess, like, if this type of movie had been made today, I mean, there's a good possibility it would be made by somebody like a Jordan Peele, who's obviously, yeah, his movies. I've not seen Nope, which apparently is very good as well, but I love Get Out and I love Us. Yeah, I think like while I don't hate this film, I do think that there could have been a better version of it, and like I'm confident that like Jordan Peele could have made a more effective version of this tale.
Yeah, I mean, I think that what this film was maybe trying to build off was the remake of The Ring, which has a similar sort of plot with kind of like an investigative female character who's trying to solve this sort of supernatural mystery.
Yeah, well, funnily enough, Adam, it's funny you say
The
that
script
because,
was
like,
written by Aaron
yeah,
Kruger.
Aaron Kruger, who wrote the remake of The Ring and its sequel, The Ring 2. He also, I mean, he's had a fascinating career. He was nominated for an Academy Award for Best Adapted Screenplay for Top Gun Maverick. So, like, he's done some good stuff. But he also wrote Transformers: Revenge of the Fallen.
Oh,
So, like, I mean, like, he's had a mixed career, man.
yeah, very hit and miss, M much like Ian Softley himself, from Kevin Spacey, from inspirational Kevin Spacey film to this,
Yeah, no, I mean, obviously, yeah, Wings of the Dove is quite critically acclaimed, things like that. Yeah, Aaron Kruger, fascinating career. He wrote the worst Scream film, Scream 3. He wrote Reindeer Games. That's interesting.
Yeah,
Like I
that was apparently hacked apart by, I think, was it Harvey Weinstein hacked it apart?
I think so. I think so. That was back in the day where we were trying to make Ben Affleck an action star. That was
Oh,
not great.
still,
But
still kind of trying to do that.
yeah, not like, but like, I just don't think like Ben A like they try to make Ben Affleck an action star because he's like 6'4" and he looks like an action star. But he's just not. He's got the Hollywood leading man looks and kind of size of an action star, but he's got the heart of a character actor, and he's better playing like a kind of like washed up alcoholic or like kind of down in his mouth kind of like he's just like the like or you know like a cop, like a burnt out cop, but not like an action movie one,
Oh
like a
no.
kind of sad drama one, Ben Affleck can be good at certain things, but he's just I don't know, like he and also like I think part of the reason he's not a good action star is because he doesn't want to be one, and he just doesn't put any effort into it. Like he just absolutely coasts, and like but then you actually see him in something he directs and he cares about, and you're like, oh, actually he has some talent.
Speaking of star that's slightly cast out of character, out of genre, how's Kate Hudson in this, do you?
So again, it kind of speaks to the movie, I guess. I think that she is good generally in this, but I think like the movie itself, I think she's good at the drama parts. I think she's good. Her interactions with Jenna Rollins are interesting. I think like her the relationship, the rapport she builds with John Hurt, I think that's quite affecting. I think she has quite a fun chemistry with Peter Sarsgaard that is a bit flirty, and there's definitely like a chemistry there that's fun. And I think she's good at all that drama stuff, but I don't think. But I think like once the peril starts to kick in more and more, I think she remains a little bit too nonchalant, and I don't think she's a good final girl. Like I just
Right.
like I'm not. I like when it comes to the horror bits, I'm not. It doesn't. Like she's pre like there's a bit towards the end where she's like basically kidnapped by Peter Sarsgaard's character,
Yes. Yeah. Spoiler.
and she's briefly really fearful, and then 2 seconds later she's a badass, and like I don't know, like she's a bit like I don't feel the peril, I don't think she's a great final girl, but I think that there's parts of the dramatic parts of this film that I think she works. And I guess like that kind of goes with like what I feel about the movie as a whole as well. So it fits.
Yeah, I mean, certainly, I think she's great in the climax. I mean, her and Sarsgaard, are told that they're told by the old woman at the gas station about Papa Justify's records, recorded sort of spell allowing people to switch bodies in order to gain more life. And then she confronts Gina Rowlands in the mansion, in the house, and kind of and tries to use her spells on her, or tries to use her methods on her, which are quite like she puts brick dust around rooms in the house to block off Gina Rowlands. She kind of drugs Gina Rowlands with her own remedy that she's been giving John Hurt, and she tells Gina Rowlands that she knows what she's doing to John Hurt, and that she's not gonna hurt him anymore. And also they do a good job of establishing a Kate Hudson becoming increasingly more believing of hoodoo, like being scared when Gina Rowlands draws a circle around herself to kind of to stop John Hurt from leaving the house with Kate Hudson, and the way she uses the brick dust to stop Gina Rowlands from entering her room. And yeah, I think she's really good at sort of playing that kind of badass action part of it. A part of it. And to be fair though, I think the reason why she can't be scared is because, one, it's not in the nature of the character, because the character of Caroline is meant to be more proactive. It would also make the character less believable as a protagonist. It would make her kind of weaker. It would be like, would somebody looking after this in a caring role really sort of give in that easily? And it also makes the action parts, where she's trying to escape from the house and the car, more believable than if she was, say, more terrified of them. What was going on?
No, I guess, like, she's quite an in control character, and that's fine. I guess, like, like, but I think there's bits where they're trying to convey that she's the terror there, and I don't think the terror
Like,
is
well,
conveyed
I
in.
think it's more like in the earlier scenes when she's investigating the hoodoo room, she's a bit muted in some of her reactions.
Yeah, no, I found it like kind of like, yeah, I found like, I think that I've kind of found that throughout the movie. I do like the climax, like, and like, I think she's good at the kind of action-y stuff, like when
Oh,
she's
yeah.
called to do the kind of action-y stuff, and kind of like the kind of standoff stuff, and like the kind of shouting back and forth, like that's fun. But yeah, I think like the kind of in terms of like conveying the horror, and I think like this is part of why the atmosphere doesn't quite ring true, because like I think because of the muted, I guess like her reactions are supposed to be slowly ratcheting up throughout
Yeah.
the movie, and like I just feel like they don't kind of reach beyond a certain level. They don't. You don't kind of feel that slow burn of like,
I don't
oh, I'm
know.
not scared, I'm not scared, I'm not scared. Oh, I'm kind of scared. Oh, I'm scared, I'm scared. I just didn't. I felt like the reactions throughout the movie were a bit too muted. And like, yeah, it's quite funny, like how she like the way she just like immediately, and maybe, maybe it's fine, but the way she immediately kind of flips, does like a complete 180, because like when she's in the tied up in the car, she is terrified,
Oh, yeah.
like 10 out of 10 terrified, and then she goes from 10 out of 10 terrified to being like 2 out of 10, I don't give a fuck, I'm gonna fuck you up, man, I'm gonna put brick dust everywhere in like a second. And like
Well,
that flip is like hilarious. I literally laughed.
to be fair though, I mean, because what happens is that Kate Hudson escapes from the house but has to leave John Hurt behind. She goes to Peter Skarsgård's place to get help, but then whilst he's sort of talking to Gina Rowlands on the phone, she finds, and this is the one part of the film I do think is doesn't work in terms of, is the way they reveal that Peter Skarsgård isn't really a lawyer, because he's got Lawyering for Dummies books on his desk. I thought that was a bit of an obvious reveal. It's like, I don't know. I think if you were pretending to be a lawyer, you wouldn't leave your lawyering for dummies books out. But
No,
she.
I guess not. I mean, it does feel it, look, that is definitely like an episode of plot convenience theater. Yeah, for
And
sure.
she finds the same ring that Papa Justify had in the attic in his house, and it turns out that he's Papa Justify reincarnated, that he's basically Papa Justify reincarnated in the lawyer's body. But somehow the lawyer that Violet that Gina Rowlands managed to get him, Peter Sarsgaard, up in the attic and got him to switch bodies with John Hurt. And now, yep, he justifies in Sarsgaard's body, and then Kate Hudson finds out, tries to fight back against Sarsgaard. Sarsgaard, rather, puts Kate Hudson in his car and takes him back to Gina Rowlands.
It's always easy to get tripped up on that one, because like, you always have to remember it's Sarsgaard, not
Ah, Sarsgaard,
Skarsgård.
right, okay, well, I've
Sarsgaard.
been saying it's
He's not.
Sarsgaard all this
He's
time.
not. He's not one of the. He's not one of the Skarsgårds. He's not one of Stellan's
Ah, he's Sarsgaard. Ah, bugger.
Sarsgaard. No
Right.
relation to any Skarsgårds. It's just
Ah,
SAA,
well,
Sarsgaard.
these wacky Swedes and their names. But yeah, I actually thought when Kate Hudson gets back to the house, I didn't find her switch into action mode that unbelievable, because she realizes she's got the brick dust and everything else that she, all the hoodoo stuff that she can use against them. So she's able to kind of use her initiative and escape from them, which I think
I guess.
also makes her more proactive rather than just being a passive victim.
Oh no! I guess like I guess like for I guess like the you know like I guess like I guess the best final girl, you know, if it like I guess the best final girls like in horror can convey like a sense of terror and being badass at the same time. Like, you know, if you watch like I don't know. I mean, the first example that came in my head is like Jamie Lee Curtis in Halloween, which is probably quite a high bar.
Oh
But
yeah,
like, you
but
know, like
that's way
I
too high a
think
bar for this film.
like which like but that's the first example that came into my head. But like, you know, like there's other examples that are maybe not quite like the best final girl of all time.
Yeah.
You know, they can kind of, you know, they can kind of have that mixture of showing that there's they're scared on the inside, but they're being proactive, and you know, and they're sticking it to the, you know, whoever the killer is, or whatever the horror that is haunting them. Whereas I just like I felt like it went from real, you know, total fear to no fear in like such a kind of quick time that I just find it quite funny. But then I still found it a fun scene. Like I still find the climax fun, and the kind of running around the house, and you know, Peter Sarsgaard and Jenna Rowlands trying to get up the stairs, you know, and they can't get up the stairs because the brick dust and all that kind of stuff. Like it's still fun, and I have to say, that as much of like the thing about slow burn horror is like it building an atmosphere, and I can't even tell you like what they did wrong for me, because like
Right.
an atmosphere in a horror movie is built through a mixture of things, and like I don't know like what's missing for me that like I found some of it dull rather than atmospheric. Because like the atmosphere is built by the camera movement, it's built by the editing, it's built by the score, it's built by the sound engineering, and like I don't know what element is missing for me, or maybe it's like the editing is too flashy or for me, or like I'm just not sure what is like blocking me from like being fully immersed, or being kind of into that atmosphere.
Is it?
However, as much as I found some of the mystery dull, like the climax and the
Oh
actual
yeah.
twist, I loved that. I thought that was really, I thought it was, I was like, I didn't see it coming. And then I was like, but they seeded it. And I was like, and then I kind of
Yeah.
went back over the movie in my head. And I was like, oh yeah, they did seed that quite cleverly. So like, I have to say that the ending really won me over. And I was like, it
Yeah.
didn't win me over so much that I pushed it into being like, I actually think this is a good film. I'm going to give this 3 stars. But like, but it definitely turned me around and definitely made me rethink the film, and I definitely, gave it a higher mark in my head once that ending hit,
Yeah,
for
because
sure, because I
oh
really
yeah.
loved it.
Oh yeah, because what happens is that Kate Hudson is eventually chased by Gina Rowlands and Peter Sarsgaard into the attic, where it turns out that the whole ritual, the Cecile and Justified body switching ritual's been laid out for her. And it turns out that both Cecile and Justified are in the bodies of Gina Rowlands and Peter Sarsgaard, respectively, that they just kept doing this same ritual on every new person that they encountered once their old bodies got too old, and so they've been body hopping ever since. And it's very creepy because you've got she's she Kate Hudson's trying to protect herself from Gina Rowlands and Peter Sarsgaard advancing on her, so she draws the circle. And because she's been using all this hoodoo stuff throughout the climax of the film, it means that she now believes in it. So, and as we remember, and from earlier on in the film, hoodoo only affects you if you believe in it. And it turns out that the circle also traps her in it as well, so she can't escape the circle that she's made for herself in the attic. So what happens at the end is Gina Rowlands pushes this mirror towards Kate Hudson, which has got like all the souls of Mama Cecile, the little girl who got possessed back in the 20s, and Gina Rowlands' character, whilst Kate Hudson's saying, no, I don't believe, as the mirror crashes into her. That's really, I'd say that's like the best moment of the film.
Yes, actually, I would agree. The funniest moment of the film, and the moment that cracked me up the most, and the moment I think the most entertaining moment of the film, is Jenna Rowlands' line delivery when she goes, "I think you've broke my legs,
Oh yeah. Yeah,
child."
because there's this whole
Which,
fight scene where she gets like pushed down the stairs and she gets up like
yeah.
she's the Terminator.
Yeah, absolute killer line. And then like I think like the topper on the twist, I think one of the kind of most kind of fun moments in the movie, and the one where you realize 100% what has happened, is when Kate Hudson takes one of Jenna Rowlands' cigarettes and lights it up, and you realize like you that you know like you're like, oh, she is possessed now. She is now like, because obviously, when the mirror crashes into her, you're 50-50. You're
Yeah.
like, did was her I don't believe convincing enough, or is she now possessed? And then, like just with that one, and I think it's quite, it's not, it's something. I mean, it's not exactly subtle, but it's not like super heavy-handed either. It's just a nice little moment of being like, yes, the possession has taken hold.
And I think
And
I
like I think that's a good moment as well.
And I think Kate Hudson does a good kind of job of portraying Cecile in her body, in terms of like the language she uses and the way she's holding the cigarette. Because Kate Hudson's not really been seen as that great an actress, because the stuff she's done before, I mean, obviously this Almost Famous, but other than that, a lot of the stuff she did up until this point was fairly kind of light, kind of
Yeah,
like rom-commy stuff.
she mainly known for rom-coms and stuff like that. So she generally wasn't seen as like any great shakes as an actress, even despite the fact that she got good reviews for her performance in Almost Famous, and which still is probably one of her best performances. But yeah, I think she's a little typecast and like as like a kind of lightweight actress who's kind of like good for romantic comedies, but not necessarily good for anything else. I like yeah, I think she has more range than that. I think like I think she is like she's not. I mean, she's not incredible. Like if if you're kind of like rating kind of like actresses of the last 25 years, you wouldn't be like
Oh no.
you wouldn't be like Kate Hudson. Kate Hudson would be in your top 20 or anything. But like, she is decent. Like, and I think she's maybe underrated because like she kind of is a bit typecast in that kind of arena, and I think she has a bit more range than people assume, and maybe she will be able to branch out a little bit more because she gave a really wild, absolute wacky performance in a movie called Mona Lisa and the Blood Moon. A couple of years back,
All
which was a
right.
movie directed by Anna Lily Amirpour, who did A
Oh,
Girl
yeah.
Walks Home Alone at
Yeah.
Night, and that was like it was. I guess it got a limited release, maybe didn't make a huge impact. Got mixed reviews, but I really enjoyed it. I think she gave a really wild performance there, and she gives like just a hilarious performance in Glass Onion. So
Oh,
like,
yeah.
maybe she'll be able to get like spread her wings a bit more and nowadays, now
Yeah.
that
So yeah, that's the end of the film. We get Kate Hudson giving Gina Rowlands, who's now got Kate Hudson in her body, some of the remedy that John Hurt was being given to keep her quiet. And then both her and Sarsgaard in John Hurt's body are being loaded into the ambulance as the black friend comes up. And she's, I guess she's meant to be their next target. Cecile and Justify's next target that they're going to use.
I guess maybe, although it doesn't really make sense because like Kate Hudson, they're supposed to be kind of the same age, so why would like I don't know, like I wasn't sure about that.
But yeah, I mean, I know that they, Pete, I know that there's this running, there's this bit at the end where, Kate Hudson complains about not having a black body, not having, you know, not being able to be in a black body. So I guess if they're not going for the black friend, then they're going to go for another young black person a couple of years down the
Yeah,
line.
I guess so. I guess so. Yeah, that moment was kind of weird, because like Peter Sarsgaard makes this weird comment about like, oh, the black ones never stay or whatever, and I was like, what?
I think
I
that's
got
more.
I don't.
I think that's meant to be because they believe in hoodoo, so they're more
Yeah.
superstitious. Whereas the
Yeah.
white,
Yeah. Likely.
but the white characters have to be talked into it. Have to be talked into going into the
Yeah.
house, discovering the attic, and actually
Right.
being
I
suckered
could
in, being
like.
suckered into, being suckered into believing it. Whereas
Yeah.
the black, whereas the, whereas black people know not to mess with that kind of stuff.
Right. So like the white people coming in are like the kind of frog in the boiling water kind of thing.
Yeah,
The people who get kind
I mean, how whether that comes across as racist or not, I don't quite know.
Yeah, I don't know. Like I felt I again it's one of the several moments in the movie that like this where like I don't think it's racist, but I just feel weird when it happens. I just feel kind of like I don't know,
Yeah.
like I just like or kind of a little uncomfortable. And then like you, I'm like, there's just a couple of moments where I'm like, is that racist?
It's
Like there's a
interesting.
few moments like that throughout the movie where I just like just a little uneasy and just feeling like maybe they didn't quite get the right end of
Yeah.
things.
I mean, because the first time I saw this film was in early 2013, which was a
Yes.
very different time, not just for horror cinema. We didn't have the likes of black-led horror films like from Jordan Peele and what have you, and in fact, there wasn't this wave of black-led American cinema that we have now. But also, I feel like culturally there was less of an awareness of problematic tropes. So when I saw the film, first off, I thought, oh, this isn't a racist film because it shows the white characters getting their comeuppance for either not believing in voodoo or for lynching the two black characters. Whereas nowadays, coming to it not just after this whole cultural wave we've had of more films about the black experience in various genres, but also with the increased awareness of, violence against black people, Black Lives Matter, what happened with George Floyd, and so on. You kind of watch this film now and you think, yeah, this doesn't quite work, this whole idea of black, the story of what is basically black vengeance, where the black characters carrying out the vengeance are still portrayed as villainous, and the majority of the main characters are white. It just doesn't, yeah, it just it feels it feels very uneasy to watch now. If that makes sense.
I think it, I think it, I think it, I think it makes sense. Obviously, many things have changed. Obviously, I mean, I'm not, oh, I'm not the probably the best source to kind of unparse this, unpackage this, because I am like a white dude, and
And
so maybe it's not the
I'm a brown dude or a light brown dude, so.
so like maybe not the best, but like you say, not many things have changed in culture, and like you like 2013 doesn't seem like that long a time ago. And like obviously there was certain problematic tropes that people talked about or were parodied or like but not maybe not with the same language, because like there's certain things of like, for example, the thing of the common trope of black characters always being killed first in slasher movies. That's something that was parodied even in the early 2000s. Like that was something that they were making jokes about even in the kind of post-Scream wave of kind of movies, like that. But yeah, I think like there's definitely a lot, there's been a lot further conversations, and like the whole tenor and dialogue around this stuff has changed. Well, like at that point, 2013, we hadn't had the Oscar So White
Oh no.
campaign, like that. Like it would still be a couple of years before the kind of the taking the knee campaign that happened in sports, where people were taking the knee for the US national anthem, which then spread to other countries as well. And that all started in 2016, and that kind of from 2016 onwards, that kind of saw the rise of like Black Lives Matters and stuff like that. And then yeah, I mean, I think if I'm remembering correctly, I think Get Out was 2017, and 2017 is a very big, very, very big year for the Get Out coming out, for the Black Lives Matter movement. Also, like 2017 is when Me Too started. So like in ter there's a lot of conversations that are very, very different now to what they were even 10 years ago. And like yeah, in many different ways. The way we talk about things has changed significantly since 2017, like that, since that kind of period.
Yeah, although in saying that, yeah, I mean, these racial issues aside, I guess I'd still, and you're going to disagree with me on this, I still think it works as a horror film. I think it's a pretty kind of slow burn, creepy kind of sense of foreboding. It's got that as the mystery slowly unfolds. It's quite atmospheric. Okay, there's one or two moments where it gets a bit cliched along the way, but on the whole, I think compared with even stuff that was coming out at the time, but would either go heavy in the gore, like the torture porn films, or some films that would be a lot more cliched, or just badly written, like for example, The Ring 2 that came out the same year as this. I think was still written by Aaron
With the same
Kruger.
screenwriter, yes.
Yeah, exactly. And it's just that's just comparing this film to The Ring 2, it's just night and day. It's And I guess
Yeah,
maybe.
I think like the screenplay I think is a bit of a mixed bag. I think like
Okay.
the kind of dialogue between like the main character like is fine, but then there's other like the kind of supporting characters, like the characters who are there to just give exposition, like the you know like the person in the shop and like the old blind lady and stuff like that. I think all that's quite clunky. But
But I
like it,
mean, but
so I
to
think
be,
it's a mixed bag of screenplay wise.
I don't know. I mean, to be fair, you do get that, like, even in modern day horror films. Like, I think the
Oh
first,
yeah, I mean I guess.
that are critically acclaimed, like the first Smile film, I think, had a huge chunks of exposition being given out by like
Yeah.
by characters explaining the nature of the curse.
I've not actually, yeah, I guess you've always got to have that when you're dealing with like kind of haunted houses or curses or possessions or you know whatever. You've got to have you just got to find a way to deliver that in like the most entertaining fashion that you can. But like you know, there's got to you know, like yeah, it's sometimes hard to you know you've got to deliver a certain amount of information to keep the audience in the loop, and it's difficult to do that in a non-clunky way, for sure. I've not actually seen Smile. As far as I'm aware, is Smile got kind of mixed reviews, but Smile 2
Yeah.
was it's my Smile 2 was more critically
No,
acclaimed.
I was the other way around. I thought the first film was okay, but the second film was worse. I just thought the second film was
Okay.
just a
I may be
whole.
getting that wrong. I just because I've not seen either of them.
No.
But
That's about
I may.
right.
Oh no, but Smile actually was 79% on Rotten Tomatoes.
But I
Okay,
think
so maybe
Smile
I'll go
2
that
did
high
get
then.
more acclaim.
Yes, 86 on Rotten Tomatoes. So yes, it did get a higher score. Yeah.
How do you think the Skeleton Key would be received if it came out today? Because I feel like one, it would be told differently. But even if it was told differently, I don't know whether it would be, because the film itself did okay. I mean, it made about 40 million on a 40 million budget in America, and it made 47 million on a 40 million budget in America. And I think internationally it did like 50 million, so it did perform solidly. I don't
It
know if that would,
probably made its money back, yeah.
yeah, I don't know if that would be the same today, whether it would maybe underperform because the standards are higher for horror.
Yeah, I think it would be I think in terms of there'd be several like you say, it'd probably be told differently. If it was the exact same movie released today, I think there would be greater discussion around the racial
Oh, yeah.
politics than there was in 2005. Even though I looking at the reviews, there was some discussion about the awkwardness of that.
Yeah.
But that would be on a higher level. There'd be more reviews kind of highlighting that and stuff like that. So that's one conversation. And yeah, I don't know, like because like I think that there is like a crowd of you know fans of kind of haunted house movies, possession movies, kind of things like that, who are maybe of a kind of more kind of Blumhouse vibe that might find this a bit too slow. But I think that like the kind of the people who are really into like neon films, A24 films, is kind of slow burn crowd. Might find that this gets a bit too hokey in moments and a bit too cliched in moments and might be a bit unsafe. So I think it might kind of, I think it might end up in the same way that it did back in the day. It kind of falls between two stools a little bit, and I think like some people, it seems to be that most people's reaction to this is like either they find it a bit too cliched and they put it in like a kind of 2-star bracket, or they find the atmosphere effective, and they think it's good, but they think it's like 3-star good. So like I think like most people are, I don't think most people think this movie is terrible, and I also don't think that most people think this movie is amazing. So it's just that kind of very fine margins. Does it not quite work for you? Maybe kind of 2, 2.5. Maybe it does kind of work for you. Maybe kind of 3, 3.5. And it's a middle ground horror, and I think it would always land in the middle ground, no matter what. That's my kind of take on it, I guess. Yeah.
So I guess you can kind of see why it's been overlooked.
Yeah, I think it's one of those movies that it is a kind of middling movie, and it's like you know middling bad for some people, middling good for some people. And I think that is the type of movie that just falls through the cracks. And like, people bring it back up and they're like, oh yeah, I remember that. And like, maybe they're like, oh, I was a bit M on it, in the day, or oh, I quite liked that back in the day. So I think like these types of movies that are kind of middle ground movies are the ones that often like get forgotten. For sure, because they don't leave a strong enough. Most people remember the really terrible movies and the really great movies. So like, they don't leave that at just a strong enough impression to kind of last through the ages. But it's interesting talking about these movies. That's the point of your podcast. And
Yep,
I think
sure
I think
is.
you've got I've got a great I think you've got a great concept. And it is fascinating to kind of find out. Not everything has to be terrible, not everything has to be great. And you can take a movie like this and look at it and kind of analyze it, and kind of see the shining moments in it, even if it's not all great, but it does have great moments. And also, I find it really fascinating watching the behind the scenes featurettes, and like, because it is like a kind of I fell slightly more on the kind of side on it, but I think it is fascinating to see, like, this isn't, it feels kind of like, watching it feels kind of like a studio product. And like, sometimes when you say studio product, you think like, oh, maybe not a lot of effort's gone into it, and it's kind of like just like all kind of marketing focus groups or whatever. But when you actually see the behind the scenes sign behind the scenes featurettes, and you actually see people talking quite passionately about it. Kate Hudson seemed to really like the script. She seemed to really like ghost stories and be into kind of supernatural, the
It's
spirit
kind of interesting
world.
that it's kind of interesting that she's not done something like this since, though.
It is interesting because like the way she talks about it, because like one of the behind the scenes featurettes is she is like Kate Hudson's personal ghost story, and like she just tells a story from her childhood where Goldie Hawn was on a shoot in London, and they were in this house and weird things kept happening, and then the owner said, oh yeah, we think this house is like haunted by like a small boy, and then like they. Goldie Hawn was like, fuck this, we'll get another house, because like these weird things keep happening to Kate Hudson. She was like, kept like being, feeling like she was pushed out of bed, and she was pushed into a pool, and she kept tripping in this one specific area of the bedroom she was in, and it was just all this weird stuff was happening. And she talked about how she's really into like kind of spiritual stuff, the spirit world, ghosts, all that kind of stuff. So it is interesting that she's never repeated this, and and it does show like the research that went into the movie in terms of the hoodoo stuff, in terms of like in terms of like the serious history of the plantation stuff, and also in terms of like the culture of New Orleans and the music. And they researched some of the jazz, some of the blues, even some of the hip hop of the time, which was there was a subgenre of hip hop called bounce that was popular in New Orleans at the time, and they really went in depth in a lot of this stuff. And so like, there's, while you might like look at this film and like roll your eyes and think it's a bit cliche, a bit paint by numbers at time, like real effort went into it. And like, and I appreciate that, the deep dives that they went into certain things, and like, they clearly had an ambition, and it didn't quite work for me, but I admire the ambition, and I admire the work that went into this movie.
Well, on that note, that's the end of our episode on the Skeleton Key. Scott, thanks for joining us. What have you got up next?
What have I got up next? When is this episode coming out?
It's coming out pretty soon, in like the next week or so.
Oh, next week or two. Oh, okay. Cool. Oh, so our next episode, so for February, we like to do like forgot like this podcast, we like to do forgotten movies. Like we do like Forgotten February, where we pick a random film from the year that we're covering, that most people will never have heard of, and I've not seen. So the movie for that will be this the February episode for All 90s Action All the Time, is a film called No Contest, which was an HBO TV movie, that is like a Die Hard ripoff. It's like Die Hard at a beauty contest. And our John McClane stand-in is played by Shannon Tweed. And like she has helped. She is given an assist from the outside by Robert Davi, and our villains are Andrew Dice Clay and Roddy Piper.
How more 80s slash early to mid 90s can you get? I mean,
So
good
there we go.
God.
I thought I like watching Die Hard knockoffs. When I saw it was Die Hard at a beauty contest and I saw that
Wow.
cast list, I was like, I've got to watch this. In fact, I've got to cover
Honestly,
this on the podcast.
I'm just surprised it's as late as 1995. I would have put it more like 93, 92 with that cast.
It feels when you watch it, it doesn't feel like 95. It's very low budget as well. It was shot in like somewhere in Canada. I think it was shot in Vancouver. It was either Vancouver or Toronto, but it's shot in Canada. And yes, it feels earlier. When you watch it, maybe because of its low budget nature, because it's like an HBO, straight to HBO movie, it feels like it was, you're watching a movie from like 92, 93 kind of thing. Doesn't feel like a 95 movie at all. Yeah, it definitely feels like it is. Like it was shot between like 91 and 93, definitely not 95. But you know, it has its fun moments. It's not a great movie. The action is not great. It's a pretty rubbish movie, really. But it has its odd fun moments. And like Roddy Piper is not given enough screen time, but gives a really committed performance and is really fun in the movie. So the movie is almost just worth watching for his performance. Yeah.
Well, you can join me next episode where I'll be looking at the 1985 Jackie Chan slash Danny Aiello action thriller, 1985 Jackie Chan Danny Aiello action thriller The Protector. Until
Oh
then,
man.
yeah, that is there's like two different versions of that. There's like an American version and a Japanese version, and I've got my hands on both versions.
Yeah, not like just quickly on this because I saw this for the first time just like last year or the year before. That is a weird movie.
It is.
Like it's real weird and like it's a combination that you would not just the Danny Aiello of it, it's just a combination that I wouldn't expect. Because, like, Jackie Chan, for most of his career, is like real clean cut.
Oh,
And, like, the
yeah.
director of that movie, James
Oh,
Glickenhouse, who
yeah.
also did, like, The
The
Exterminators,
Exterminator movies,
is
the polar opposite.
real sleazy director. So, like, how they ended, how, like, and I know he hates the film. I know Jackie hates the film.
Yeah.
But, like, how they ended up in that situation, God
It's
alone knows.
like he ended up on the set of Death Wish 3. It really
Yeah,
does.
no, he doesn't fit in the film at all.
I
Like
mean,
it's I mean, it's an interesting film,
I
but
mean,
like
listening to Jackie Chan saying like Dirty Harry or Cobra's lines is like, what? It's such a weird experience as a Jackie Chan fan.
oh yeah, it's there's a real disconnect there. It like yeah, the way that he's like done, like you say, like a Cobra, like a Dirty Harry, kind of like a smarmy anti-hero, like and it just oh, it's real weird. But anyway, yes, I'm sure your listeners will thoroughly enjoy that. I will definitely check out that
Well,
episode because it's a real weird movie.
yeah. Well, until that episode, keep watching.